James Holman was known simply as the Blind Traveller, a solitary, sightless adventurer who fought the slave trade in Africa, survived a frozen captivity in Siberia, hunted rogue elephants in Ceylon, and helped chart the Australian outback. Once a celebrity, a best-selling author, and an inspiration to Charles Darwin, charismatic, witty Holman outlived his fame, dying in an obscurity that endured until Jason Roberts wrote his biography entitled Sense of the World. And Jason Roberts joins me now from San Francisco. Hello, Jason. Thanks for joining me on the show.
Thank you, Sam. Pleasure to be here.
Where did it all begin for James Holman?
It all began for James Holman in Exeter, as a matter of fact. He was born in 1786 and grew up the son of an apothecary. And he grew up dreaming of seeing the world. In fact, he says that was his earliest memory, was of hoping to go out and explore the entirety of the world. And he thought he would do so when he joined the Navy, the Royal Navy, when he was 12 years old. But he's off fighting the Napoleonic Wars, and like a lot of people who joined the Navy to see the world, he ended up not seeing much more than the deck of a ship at sea. And he persisted in his naval career, and it was when he was 25 years old, he was struck by a sudden illness that apparently is some sort of nerve immune-related thing. It was a mystery even to him, but he went suddenly and profoundly and permanently blind. And that was very much a catastrophe for somebody in the early 1800s in the United Kingdom. There was all kinds of stigma about blind young people. The vast majority of blind young people at the time were suffering from venereal disease, and there were absolutely no resources in place for rehabilitation, for mainstreaming, anything of that sort. And so he was really went almost in a stroke from being a young naval lieutenant on the rise at the very height of expectation, which is what he calls himself, to being one step away from being a beggar on street corners. Very much a dramatic time in his life.
And yet he went from this to studying medicine.
Yes. As far as I can tell, he had a degree of audacity that was apparent at him in him from his earliest youth. And he sprung back from that with the opportunity. What he did is he engineered to get himself named a Naval Knight of Windsor, which meant that he got to live in Windsor Castle in company with King George III at the time, who, by the way, was also blind at that particular moment. And then what he did is he took the resources from that and went to the University of Edinburgh and became, as far as I can tell, the first blind person to get a medical degree. He studied very intently, and he actually didn't quite get the medical degree, but that's only because he didn't want to pay the £40 fee that you get for the actual diploma. But he did, in fact, study enough medicine to practice medicine, and there were points throughout his life that he seems to have saved the lives of many people through his medical knowledge.
How did his travels begin? Because he traveled right around the world, didn't he?
Well, the most fascinating thing, the biography that I've written is called A Sense of the World, but the subtitle is How a Blind Man Became History's Greatest Traveler. And that was the most fascinating aspect of the story, because I set out to write about him as simply someone who, as you pointed out, Simon, was famous as the blind traveler. But as I got and researched it more and more and more, I found that he was actually the most prolific traveler of all time. That was a record that appears to have stood up until the 20th century, up until the invention of the internal combustion engine and general mass transportation, at the very least. My estimate, and it's only a rough estimate, I can't be held to it because the documentation is spotty, but that by the time that he died in 1857, he had traveled alone, mind you, about 250,000 miles. Which is about the equivalent of going to the moon.
How well prepared was he for his travels? You know, I mean, was he wealthy enough to sort of just head out and live off his own resources?
No, he was not at all. He had absolutely no resources. The Knights of Windsor that he was in were regularly called the Poor Knights of Windsor because they had almost nothing of an annual stipend. On the equivalent of, oh my gosh, I would say that he was earning about £300 a year, which might be the modern equivalent now. He was, in fact, going around the world almost constantly for 30 years or so. Not only was he completely broke, but he was also in debilitating health, because the illness that had struck him down, it had not only rendered him blind, but it had rendered him intermittently crippled. He quite often was unable to walk. He was suffering from debilitating, really painful rheumatism. And for some reason, that didn't stop him. In fact, when he set off to go on his trip to go around the world, he was literally unable to walk at that moment. He had to be carried on board the ship that was taking him off on his trip. So this is somebody who literally did not let the slightest excuse ever stand in his way from doing what he really wanted to do, which was to experience the world as deeply and fully as possible.
And yet he endeavored to change things. I mean, he had a river named after him in Africa. He was so well respected. He also tried to fight the slave trade as well, didn't he?
You know, it's very interesting because James Holman was quite famous in his day. He was almost generically famous. You could walk into a Victorian living room and start referring to the blind traveler, and everybody knew exactly who you were talking about. When he died in 1857, he was, in fact, still deemed famous enough to warrant an entry in the Encyclopedia Britannica. And it was just over time that he had been so forgotten. Within a few generations, that entry in the Britannica had shrunk to maybe a few paragraphs, and by the 1950s, it had disappeared altogether. So I found this is somebody who had actually disappeared from our memory. He had done amazing things. He was, in fact, involved in fighting the slave trade, had actively done that, was part of an exploration team in not only in Africa, but he also helped chart the Australian outback as well. Many just amazing things that he had done, and it was always simply a case of moving himself forward. It was always forward momentum. But his books were best-selling books at the time. He was a best-selling author. He was a member of the Royal Society. If you look in The Voyage of the Beagle by Charles Darwin, Charles Darwin actually cites him as an authority. If you look in the books of Sir Richard Francis Burton, Sir Richard Francis Burton refers to him. So you find that this is somebody who, not only was he famous, but some of the main people in Victorian thought at that time were also constantly referencing him. And it's just astonishing that he could fall so thoroughly off our internal memory.
And he had a bit of an adventure in Russia as well, didn't he?
He did, as a matter of fact. He set out to be the first person to circumnavigate counterclockwise around the globe over land. And this was not that he was the first blind person to do so. Had he pulled this off, he would have been the first person, period, ever to do so. And he did that by simply going to Russia and hiring a cart and going as far across Siberia as possible. And he got almost to the edge of the Chinese border. And this is 1817, you have to understand. He got as far as the Chinese border when all of a sudden the Tsar of Russia arrested him, believed he was a spy, didn't believe that he was actually blind. We have to understand that we are on the other end of about 200 years of sensitivity training toward sight-impaired and blind people in this world. At that particular time, the idea that a blind person could do these things seemed contradictory on the face of it. So they honestly believed that by virtue of him managing to do these things, he must have been faking his blindness. They held him as a prisoner. They held him in captivity. They forcibly transported him right across the country, once again, 4,000 or 5,000 miles in the dead of Siberian winter, and literally had to expel him from the country in the opposite direction. That was his first attempt to try to travel around the world. He did eventually succeed, but the most interesting thing is that every single time when he did take off, not only did he have the challenge of being blind, not only did he have the challenge of traveling alone, not only did he have the challenge of having almost no money, but he had to do it through subterfuge. He had to pretend that he wasn't actually trying to travel around the world, because if anybody had gotten on to that, what he was trying to do, they would have put him in an insane asylum. So the story of his achievements are multiply layered, and in a sense of the world, I was very much challenged and very much a pleasure to try to convey that.
Was he a charismatic man?
He was very much a charismatic man. That's the very interesting thing. He was a handsome devil. He was very well spoken. He was actually an accomplished poet as well. Had a photographic memory, so he was able to regale any of his fellow travelers with wonderful stories, things that he had memorized. And it's clear that he was very, very much attracted to women, and women were very much attracted to him. One of the interesting things that at that time, blind people were kind of assigned a neuter role in society, which meant that for some reason they thought that he was incapable of perceiving female beauty, and therefore he was utterly harmless. So at that particular time, when men and women were not allowed to socialize with each other, he was allowed to actually cohabitate with people and with females, and people thought nothing of it. And I have stories of him cohabitating and spending the summer with a glamorous Italian countess and so on and so forth. And it's clear from his writing that there's a great degree of romance happening, and but it's still, he's very discreet. So this is a person who was almost indelibly remembered by everybody who encountered him, even if they encountered him for only a few minutes. I have diary entries from the 1830s, 1840s, from people who literally would just meet him for 5 minutes and remember him for the rest of their lives. The charisma, however, wasn't just across genders. The main thing that he had to do is this unusual thing. He had to develop what I call kind of a slingshot personality. Because he was committed to always traveling alone, what he would have to do was, when he would enter a new town, he would have to find people and be able to develop fast, immediate friendships and bonds of trust with people, people he can't see, mind you, and quite often people whose language he doesn't have in common. But at the same point, he can't go too far because their solicitousness, if they're too solicitous of his health, of his care, then they'll want to travel with him. So he always needed to kind of slingshot his way. He needed to immediately make friends, but then he also needed to be able to make sure that they would let him go when it was time for him to move on.
With a man who had accomplished so much and obviously had the charisma, how is it that he fell into obscurity?
That's a very good question, Simon. And that was another one of the mysteries that I had to kind of unravel. The thing that I can only figure out is that when he began his travels, it was in the era in which exploration was still this great and dangerous thing, where the voyages of Captain Cook were still fresh in people's minds, where the idea that it was this incredible adventure still to go to India or China or anything like that, the idea that it was fraught with danger. But as he went further on in his life, like I said, he died in 1857, and by that time, that was the height of the Victorian Empire, and the Victorian sensibility at that time was not wanting to be reminded that the world was a dangerous place, that you had to engage in essentially extreme travel, but that it was a reassuring place and that it was, in fact, very much this global empire. And people were less interested in the reminders that that there were all kinds of hardships to endure in travel. Instead, they wanted to be reassured. And Holman's style of writing was not your basic kind of imperialistic, patronizing sort of journalism. It was very much alive to the hazards of the road and to people as individuals. He didn't make that many class distinctions, so in that way he kind of became a little bit of a unwanted person in the Victorian literary pantheon of the time. And that seems to be why he began to fade.
Well, Jason, it's a really intriguing story. How can we get a copy of A Sense of the World, your book?
It should be located in most bookstores. It is published in the UK by Simon & Schuster. It's available in both hardcover and paperback, and also large print and audiobook as well.
Oh, Jason, thank you very much.
Thank you.